Yes, well, I better show you how amazing it is right away before I say anything else. But just to draw attention to the fact this is Cambridge, as you all know. I show this deliberately. This is a photograph taken from the top of the Rann Library looking down on the river. And that punt is subject to two modes of instability, as anyone will realize who has attempted to navigate the River Cam. And these two modes of instability appear and are very important for the rattleback also. They are the pitching mode and the rolling mode. So this gives some little motivation in addition for showing the photograph. As Andrew says, of course, it's always sunny in Cambridge. And it's always raining here, as we know, in California. I'll show you this rattleback, I think, right away. It's best if you, yes, please cover the. This is the rattleback, and it's a little. I would describe it as a canoe-shaped object, which has two radii of curvature at the base, where it sits on the table, let's say, in stable equilibrium. And if I rotate this object here in the anti-clockwise direction, nothing very exciting happens. Of course, it's subject to a little weak frictional dissipation of some kind, which brings it to rest. Nothing very surprising there. Although I should point out that there is, to my knowledge, no theory that will tell you what the frictional, the appropriate frictional coefficient is for a problem of this kind. And indeed, obviously you start with kinetic energy when you rotate it in this way, and the kinetic energy is damped out, comes to rest, and just how that mechanism operates is, to my knowledge, unknown. Now, that's of course not very interesting. I couldn't give a whole lecture on that, but let's try it in the opposite direction. Try to rotate that in the clockwise sense, then something very funny. It may be just that I'm having a bad morning, and I'll try again. I do it as carefully as I possibly can, and it doesn't like it. It reverses its sense of direction. It doesn't like clockwise, and it does like anti-clockwise. That could be, and we ought to perhaps repeat this experiment south of the equator before. But we'll find that Coriolis forces do play a part in this, but it's not the Earth's rotation, of course. It would be nice if it was. I have a second example here, and let me just try this one. So, anti-clockwise, okay. Slowly comes to rest, maybe a slightly different frictional coefficient. Anti-clockwise, oh, it just doesn't want to do it at all. Especially, sorry? Man effect? Oh yes, it is manufactured, it's true. And I have searched the beach here to try and find a stone that will behave in this way when rotated. And I have a great collection of stones and shells. And I'm sure that one day I'll come on one that exhibits this property. It should do. But it needs to be long and thin for a start. It needs to have two very different radii of curvature. And it has to have another property, which I will describe in a moment, in order to give you this effect. Well, that's the rattleback, and naturally we want to explain this rather unusual and surprising phenomenon. It's surprising when you first see it, Often things, when you first see them for the first time, are a surprise. Could we remove the... Thank you. And but when you've thought about it for 4 or 5 years, it becomes very obvious. It's no longer surprising at all. Oh, yeah, thanks, Andrew. You might ask, how did I get into a problem of this kind? I lectured here at KITP 8 years ago when we had a program on turbulence. And I lectured on a toy known as Euler's disk and its finite time singularity. Of course, that was the interest in that toy for me. It's a disk that precesses on its rim, and the rate of precession increases and appears to approach infinity at finite time as the angle of inclination goes to zero. Of course, nothing ever goes to infinity in real life, and so that infinity is resolved. But anyway, that was the subject of the talk I gave in the year 2000. And that Euler's disk led a lecture I gave in Cambridge. Somebody raised the question, can you apply the same technique to the problem of the rising egg? I didn't know what the rising egg problem was, but I have eggs here to show you what it is. The rising egg problem, which I spent about 3 years on with Yutaka Shimomura, and then Michael Braniski, who came to me from Warsaw as a research student. I had him on other problems, magnetic reconnection to begin with, but I said I needed a little help on the computing for the rising egg problem, and he got totally absorbed in that problem and spent most 90% of the 3 years of his PhD on the rising egg problem, the remaining 10% on the magnetic reconnection. Well, the rising egg led to the rattleback, as you can imagine. I mean, you get more and more fascinated by this sort of mechanical behavior. I would just say that, I say here, the rising egg led to the rattleback and chiral dynamics, and I describe this as a tabletop model of geomagnetic reversals. That's a big claim, obviously, and I'll want to justify that a little bit for you. But I'll just say that toys of this kind provide surprising phenomena. They provide dynamical insights once these phenomena are understood, and they provide a lot of fun. And there is a picture here of which may be well known to you, of Pauli and Niels Bohr. I think this was, I'm not sure of the date, but I think it was about in the 1950s. And they are, as you see, totally absorbed in the behavior of this little toy, which is known as the tippy top. It is a mushroom-shaped top with a spherical base and a little handle, and you spin it very rapidly, and it turns upside down. And that problem was actually solved and only understood in the 1950s. The fact that it has a spherical base when it starts its reversal is very important. As far as the mathematics is concerned, it's a great aid to solving the problem, as you can imagine. But the rising egg problem has some important similarities with this tippy-top problem, which is itself quite fascinating. Anyway, this and these two eminent scientists, they provide a distinguished precedent for the investigation of spinning objects. Yes. Well, they probably had a reason for this, because the behavior of these things often does depend very much on the quality of the surface, the smoothness, and so on. And actually, for this, you do need slipping friction. It must slip. It mustn't roll. If you try to do the tippy top on, say, a hard sheet of rubber, so that it rolls, it will not rise. Nothing will make it rise. So it's got to be slipping. And this is one of the features that comes out again in the mathematical analysis of the problem. The rattleback. I should say, it's the technical name for the rattleback is the SELP, which is a rather curious word, and one wonders why. But it's the word that was used in the first paper that can be tracked down on this topic very good paper by G.T. Walker, who was working in Cambridge at the time, and this journal was published in Trinity Street in Cambridge in the 1890s. Walker later made a great reputation for himself in atmospheric physics, and I think in particular he's perhaps known to anyone here in the climate business for his work on atmospheric dynamics in the tropics in the early 20th century. It was Walker who used the word celt to describe such an object. It is a word, the word celt does appear in the Oxford English Dictionary. And normally it's a chisel-shaped object that was well known and used by prehistoric man. So I like to think that prehistoric man would be wandering on the beaches of Santa Barbara, possibly, and once he had satisfied his hunger, he would have nothing to do but pick up stones, interesting shapes and sizes, and play with them on slab of rock. So perhaps the behavior of the rattleback is one of the earliest scientific discoveries. And this perhaps also why we have this very ancient word in the English language. I can comment a little bit more on etymology of this word, but later on. So it's a rigid body that exhibits the property of spin asymmetry, can spin quite smoothly on a table in one sense, but when spun in the opposite sense, in fact, you may have noticed a pitching instability develops, which extracts energy from the spin to such an extent that this spin actually reverses in sign. Now, at this point, I'm afraid this is a mixed mode lecture, and I had too much difficulty putting the equations onto PowerPoint. So if you forgive me, I'll use, that's right. I will use transparencies for the bit of mathematics involved, and it turns out to be not very complicated. But it helps matters to take a very specific object with specific geometry. So consider first an ellipsoid with surface x squared over a squared, y squared over b squared plus z squared over c squared equals 1, where a greater than b greater than c. Uniform solid ellipsoid of mass capital M sitting on a table in equilibrium, so the least axis, semi-major axis is this one, c. And the table is then z equals minus c if we take origin at the center, and gravity 0, 0, minus g. And let me use units of mass, length, and time to make the whole thing dimensionless. M for mass, c for length, square root of c over g for time. If I use these equivalently, we just take m, c, and g equal to 1. Then p is the point 0, 0, minus 1. This is the point, sorry, it's not marked here, p, the point of contact with the table. And the principal moments of inertia of this body at the point P, of course, we know what they are at the origin for an ellipsoid, so we have the parallel axis theorem to get them at P, and the three principal moments of inertia at P are B squared plus 6 over 5, A squared plus 6 over 5, and A squared plus B squared over 5. That 6 comes as 1 plus 5, and the extra 5 is because of the shift from O to P. So these are the principal moments of inertia, and they are obviously play a part in the dynamics. Near P, the contact surface is locally given by, well, a local parabolic approximation. Z equals minus 1 plus x squared over 2a squared plus y squared over 2b squared. So the a and the b being these semi-major axes. And if you disturb an ellipsoid of that kind from rest, it's pretty obvious that there are two oscillatory modes. One is the pitching mode. So if I take x here, I'm sorry, what's happened to the slide, but x in the long direction, the direction of the axis A, the greatest semi-major axis, and I'll take A considerably greater than B, then you get a frequency of pitching 5 a squared minus 1 over a squared plus 6, that's the pitching mode. And the other mode, in the y direction, transverse to the screen, y double dot plus omega 2 squared y equals 0. Omega 2 squared, similarly, 5b squared minus 1 over b squared plus 6. So there's the gravitational rocking, and the appropriate inertia enters into that calculation. This is a sort of trivial calculation that we hope our undergraduate students are able to handle. So these are the pitching and rolling modes. Now, in fact, if you rotate such an ellipsoid with angular velocity n spin about the vertical, then these two modes become coupled, but they remain stable. Spin alone will not destabilize anything. They remain stable. There's a coupling between the two, and the frequencies change a little bit. So that can also be quite easily calculated. Now we want to have a chiral distortion of this ellipse to make it just like the rattleback. And we imagine that the mass is redistributed inside the ellipse. I mean, either we distort the surface of the ellipse a little bit, the ellipsoid, or we can simply redistribute the, we can keep the surface the same. This is a more, the conjurer's way of doing it, and we simply rearrange the density distribution in the interior. And this is the way we describe it. Imagine mass redistributed inside the ellipsoid, so that the principal axes of inertia at P are rotated through a small angle about the vertical relative to the principal axes of curvature at the point P. That's the key thing. And that is the property of this little rattleback. Let OXYZ be the principal axis of inertia, so rotated. Then the local equation for the surface is slightly rotated, as it were, relative. It's still parabolic, but it's got this sort of cross term, chi x y over a squared, where chi is the small perturbation parameter related to the small angle. So chi is small, and chi, obviously, for chirality, and it's very appropriate. Chir, I understand, is the Greek word for hand, and chirality is handedness, distinction between right hand and left hand. So I attribute this to my colleague Tadashi Tokieda, who is a great linguist, Japanese, but a scholar of European languages, and comes up with some marvelous information of this kind. So, the pitching mode is, you've got a long axis, A greater than B. So the pitching mode is oscillation that way. The rolling mode is about the other axis. Okay?
So.
Yes. It's rolling. It's an oscillatory mode. Here, it's easier seen with the actual rattleback. It's that mode of oscillation, whereas pitching is that mode of oscillation. There are two modes of oscillation, all right? It's the same, of course, the same type of mode, but I've got to use, and these are the words that are used by sailors to describe the, when you have a boat that is longer than it's wide, which is normal. Okay, so even airplane, yeah. And in fact, I will make the assumption that A is much greater than B, or A squared much greater than B squared, because again, that's a considerable simplification. Okay, now, Well, so we've distorted the thing, and you can actually see it. Now, you probably noticed it. You can see it in the optical axis of this object. You see, it's not straight. It's slightly bent in the form of an S, and that is the distortion. One end is bent very slightly one way, the other way. And I would break the stick if I did too. No. It's a uniform density, but it's the shape. In the case of the toy, it's the shape. But it's actually, from a dynamical point of view, it's exactly the same. The key thing is this rotation of the moments of inertia relative to the axis of curvature. That's all there is. So you can see now this one pointing this way, and if I rotate it that way in the direction of which it's pointing, then it it's the good direction, you might say, for rotation. If I try to rotate it against that, it's the bad direction. Although the perturbation of geometry is very small. I'll pass it around. I mean, you can look at it and you can see there's something not quite right. You might say it's an imperfection in the manufacture of the object. But that's enough to cause this dramatic difference in effect. So this small deformation of geometry does lead to an instability. And this is what I call a chiral instability, because it's entirely, well, due to this chi effect. The body can obviously spin with angular velocity n about the vertical. And the effect of chirality is to destabilize pitching or rolling or both. And there's the paper that I suppose got me in there. The paper I knew on this topic was by none other than Hermann Bondi, the eminent cosmologist who died a couple of years ago. Worked with Fred Hoyle on the steady state theory of the universe in the 1950s. Yes, bears on everything. And he was evidently fascinated by this problem. And he wrote a paper, and it's, as you would expect, a very thorough and interesting paper, published in Prop. Rysock in 1986. But he limited attention to the stability of objects of this kind, the stability of these modes of oscillation. And doing a linear stability analysis, he assumed that the spin n was constant, which is fair enough. You take a possible steady spin solution of the dynamical equations, perturb it slightly, you get x and y perturbations, and you work out the equations. Now it's quite a business to work out the equations for a rigid body of this kind. You know, it's a sort of sixth order dynamical system generally, with no slip, assumed no slip contact at the point P. And you need the moments of inertia and rate of change, Euler's equation for rigid body dynamics, and so on. But okay, you've got to do it carefully, and Bondi, you can trust, he did it extremely carefully. He got the equations right. So he got the equations, well, for the X and Y modes and how they are actually, in general, modified by both chirality. He didn't call it chirality, but he was aware, as indeed Walker was. Walker, way back in 1896, was aware that the important thing was this slight rotation of the axis of inertia. So I'm taking Bondi's equations as my starting point, but under three assumptions. Firstly, that n is small, the spin. Now, small, remember, compared with 1, so we're using the time scale square root of c over g. So when I spin it in this way, the n is small. If I try to spin it as rapidly as possible, then that n would become of order 1 or greater. And that's what we have to do with the egg to get interesting dynamics. The egg problem, n has to be greater than about 5. But for the rattleback problem, we restrict to n small compared with 1. Chi small compared to 1. Now, chi can be positive or negative, depending on which way you do the S twist. I should say, with chi non-zero, and I ought to have mentioned it, we have an object that is not mirror symmetric. So chirality, again, is a good word to use. It's a measure of the lack of mirror symmetry. If I take the mirror image of this object, then it's impossible by simple translation and rotation to make it coincide with its mirror image. So it's not mirror symmetric. And I'm going to assume further that a squared is much greater than b squared. That's not essential, but it's just to get simple equations. So we've got a long, thin body. Then, and let's take b, well now b greater than 1 is necessary for this position to be stable. For that to be the position of stable equilibrium, b is greater than 1. But I want also b to be not just too close to 1, not to 1 plus epsilon. So b minus 1, I'm going to later assume, is itself of order 1. B might be 2 or but A is much greater than B. Under these three conditions, Bondi's equations for the oscillatory modes can be arranged at leading order in this parameter in this form. Now you see the two operate dominant parts of these equations on the left. And then you see two terms that I've underlined which appear. Term involving this small chirality here, so this is perturbation, with y double dot. And a term here involving the spin, capital, I've used capital N, which is related to small n in this simple way, times x dot equals, now there's a whole lot of terms on the right hand side. About six terms here, and about six terms at least here, and I've called them garbage terms. And the reason is that when one does the, they're all linear, because this is still linearized analysis, linear in X and Y. And when one does the, the usual e to the I omega t analysis to find what the new frequencies are and what the eigenvectors are for this new problem, you find that these garbage terms move the omega 1 and omega 2 slightly along the real axis. But that's really of very little interest. They change the frequencies a little bit. The only terms which can cause instability are the ones that they put on the left, chi y double dot and n x dot. And they, in conjunction, it needs both of them, together, move the omega 1. Of course, there's a minus omega 1 and there's omega 2 minus omega 2. They move them off the real axis in the way that I've indicated. Actually, they do that in that direction when n chi is greater than 0. We'll see later, but the arrows will be reversed if n chi is less than 0. So, the garbage terms, linear in x and y and small, move omega 1 and omega 2 slightly along the real axis. Only these terms are jointly responsible for instability. So, we don't really lose anything by simply dropping the garbage terms. We dispose of the garbage. You recycle the garbage. Yeah. Well, in fact, as I say, it's sufficient to consider the simplified system. And this is a huge simplification compared with what Bondi was faced with. And for a long time, I was stuck with the very rather complicated with all these terms. And the idea of going to second order, which in a way we have to do, was just too daunting. It was too much work. And that's what held this up for some time. But in fact, this is all that is needed. So we retain two terms. Firstly, a small change in the pitching mode, that's this mode, due to chirality, and a small change in the rolling mode, that's this one, due to what you recognize as a Coriolis effect. So Coriolis does come in. And that couples the X and Y oscillations. And here I might say you might compare, these equations look very reminiscent, we've met them before in the dynamo context. The equations for the alpha omega dynamo, if you take the simplest equations as found by Gene Parker a long time ago for components, one component of magnetic field, this is sort of model often used in galactic dynamo studies, a B in the Y direction and A, a vector potential component in the same direction. These are coupled in this sort of way, in the simplest situation, where you have our friend the alpha effect here, alpha related to helicity, and helicity is obviously a measure, a manifestation of chirality in a fluid motion. And in the second equation, you have a term which is differential rotation, and differential rotation takes the counterpart here is the Coriolis effect. Of course, this is a rather loose and weak analogy. But you can see it is these two effects in conjunction, and you need both of them to give the alpha-omega dynamo. And it's a product of the alpha and the grad U in effect, which is like omega. It's the product that gives you the dynamo number, which has to be greater than a critical value. So it's not dissimilar. You can see why I find this analogy appealing. Well, we go back to these equations and we look for the normal modes, e to the I omega t. We get a characteristic equation, which is very simple, quadratic. Well, it's now we've got omega squared here, so it's quartic in omega. The perturbation term does involve the product, n chi, and it's an omega cubed term here. But this n chi is small, so the roots are indeed perturbed slightly to omega 1. If I take the positive real axis, omega 1 minus I sigma 1, omega 2 minus I sigma 2, where sigma 1 is n chi omega 1 squared over 2, omega 1 squared minus omega 2 squared. I should have pointed out that omega 1 squared is greater than omega 2 squared. The pitching frequency is greater than the rolling frequency. The fact that they're different that makes people seasick. You just don't know what's going to happen. It gives a quasi-periodic behavior. And that is not very pleasant. So these are the roots, and you see it's very important. There's a minus sign here, plus sign here. So when one mode is stable, apparently the other mode is unstable. So we have these growth rates, and I just repeat them up here, sigma 1 and sigma 2, and the corresponding eigenvectors are very easily found. Corresponding to sigma 1, the eigenvector x1, y1 is 1 and a small perturbation, because n we're thinking of as small. And that's nearly the pitching mode, nearly in the one direction. Slightly perturbed and slightly phase adjusted. And the rolling mode, second mode with sigma 2, has got chi here, chi omega 2 squared over this pair, and 1. So it's nearly 1 again, chi being small, it's nearly in the y direction. So nothing surprising. But the main thing is that if n chi, this product, is positive, then pitching, which involves this factor, is unstable because sigma 1 is positive. But rolling, involving e to the I sigma 2t, is stable because this one is negative. Conversely, if n chi is less than 0, then we simply switch, because n chi appears in both, we switch the stabilities. So if n chi is less than 0, then pitching is stable and rolling is unstable. Now, chi is given, so we might as well assume that the distortion of our body is such that chi is positive. Okay, I mean, you might have another one for which it's negative, but it's given. It's not going to change with time. An interesting problem to consider a snake for which the S does change, and the chi could. But we've got a rigid body. And I should say that this does agree with the observed behavior of long, thin rattlebacks. We can look at it again and take this one and see if we can detect that. If I rotate it in the bad direction, try and, you see that wobble? Well, it's a pitching instability that develops. The instability mode, you can see it very clearly. It's unstable. Whereas if I rotate the other way, now the other way, the pitching mode is supposed to be stable and the rolling mode is supposed to be unstable. Well, let's just look and see. See if you can see a rolling mode developing. It's perhaps, I don't really see it. No, I didn't see it at all. Well, sometimes you do see it, a little roll that way, but if it occurs, it's pretty weak. We'll try once more. It's unstable, it therefore should have a growing, that rolling mode should have a growing amplitude. No, I can't see it. I can't see it there. Well, let's fact we can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. It's very weak. Right. Now, we'll have to go to the nonlinear terms in order to describe this behavior, because obviously the spin is not constant. It's changing, and we're the whole object of this is trying to explain the change of sign. So we have to use a two-timing analysis. Note that sigma 1 and 2, the growth rates being of order n chi, are small compared with 1. So there's whereas the omega 1, 2 are both of order unity. In fact, maximum value, when you have very long a going to infinity, the maximum value of omega 1 is omega 1 squared, I think it is 5. It doesn't get beyond that. But, so they're of order 1. They're between, say, about 2 and 5. Order 1, sigma 1, 2, by contrast, are small. N is constant only on a linearized analysis. In fact, when, say, pitching is unstable, this pitching mode extracts energy from the spin. So the magnitude of N must decrease on the slow time scale associated with this growth rate. So let's introduce a slow time scale tau. Well, we'll use chi, small parameter, over 2 times lambda minus 1, where lambda, omega 1 over omega 2 squared, is greater than 1. Greater than 1, times t. And this is the slow time variable. Yes. Absolutely. Oh yes, the damping is the key. Damping is very important for all three modes. When I say three now, there's pitching, rolling, and spin, the basic spin. And they're all subject to damping, and this is an unsolved problem. What are the appropriate damping coefficients? Not yet. Not yet. At the moment, no damping. So we have slow time variable is naturally defined in this way. Now the amplitudes a0 of t and b0 of t, think of it as x going like a0 of slow variable, I should say tau here, not t, slow variable, should dA by dt, well, A is proportional to E to the sigma 1 t. So dA by dt is sigma 1 times A. That's all I've written here. dB by dt, and it is t, is sigma 2 b. But sigma 1, sigma 2 being small, we change the variable, take chi positive, then these equations become dA0 by dtau with a slow variable, lambda n A0, dB0 by dtau is minus n b0. You see where the n comes from, n was in both sigmas. And we've only used chi to define a slow time scale. So we do have n here. And that's appropriate because n, we have to allow n to be a function of this slow variable tau. So here we have these two equations. And these two, even though n is varying on the slow time scale, you immediately have an integral of the two. Take b0 times this and plus lambda a0 times the other, you get this integral of the two equations. But there are three variables, so we need, of course, something else. Now, it's here that I want to neglect dissipative effects. And we'll come back to that, of course. Well, let's just first neglect dissipative effects because we don't know how to handle them anyway. What else can you do? If we neglect dissipative effects, i.e. assume no slip condition, neglect air friction, etc., then energy, and there's kinetic and potential energy associated with all these modes, particularly the instability mode, is conserved. Total energy is conserved. Now, the energy of the pitching mode, half beta, that's one of the moments of inertia, x dot squared plus omega 1 squared x squared, the usual sort of kinetic and potential energy, and it takes this one proportional to a0 squared. The energy of the rolling mode, similarly, proportional to B0 squared. And there's energy in the spin, which is a half gamma, moment of inertia about the vertical, times n squared. And that little n was related to big N in this way. So we can rescale A0 and B0, just define appropriate variables A and B, so that this conservation of energy becomes A squared plus B squared plus N squared equals a constant, rooted in simple form. And the two equations for A and B are unchanged by introducing this these factors. You get still dA by dTau is lambda nA, dB by dTau is minus nB. They're simply linear factors we've removed. And if I differentiate this equation for energy, dN by dT will involve an A dA by dT, B dB by dT. Here's these two, and you get the third equation for dN by dTau, minus lambda A squared plus B squared. And this is a simple third-order nonlinear system for A, B, and N, with two integrals that we've got already. I mean, the energy integral and the one I had before, A, B to the lambda equals a constant. Well, these two integrals in the phase space of A, B, and N, this is a sphere, and this is a sort of quasi-hyperbolic cylinder, J equals constant. A, B to the lambda, you use curves, hyperbolic-type curves in the A, B plane, A and B being positive. And so we take these cylinders and they slice, they intersect the sphere, spheres in closed curves, which are trajectories of the system. So the solutions are periodic. You're around these closed curves. They're periodic. Now we can go back to this, because here, fortunately, I do have... Well, this is just repeating these three equations. But here you'll notice I've taken the three equations and I've introduced three frictional terms which will... This is it's the best we can do. We don't know how to calculate the effects of friction. So it's an open problem. So this is the semi-empirical bit. We put in the A equation, a minus mu1A, in the B equation, a minus mu2B. So this is saying that this pitching mode is subject to friction. We don't quite know what it is. Well, of course, there's air all around. So there's a little bit of air viscosity, and particularly near the point of contact. The air is being pushed around that singular point. And also, there may be very slight deformation of the two surfaces, a little bit of plastic deformation. I mean, it's one of these very difficult questions. And the amazing thing is we do not know the answer. How to calculate mu1? Yes, I'm saying there's no... There may be a little bit of slip as well. That's true. And then that would contribute, obviously, to the factors mu1. Yeah, that's true. You might improve, you might get a good a sort of rough dimensional estimate for each of these mu's, but still it wouldn't be a theory. Not a, you know, from starting from the fundamental equations of... I really don't know. I mean, we're in dimensionless variables, so these are just numbers, and I'm taking them to be small compared with one. Small numbers, small frictional coefficient. We'll come to the effect in a moment. Friction parameters. Now, if anyone knows how to calculate them, that'd be wonderful. They should come out as determined by properties of the rattleback and of the surrounding medium, in other words, air, and possibly properties of the table, possibly even properties of the whole lecture room. That is the difficulty. I don't know. Yes, that's the simplest linear damping. I mean, it might be far worse. Might be my new. Well, I mean, we don't know. But empirically, Yes, and do it on the basis of measurements. Yes, well, this works very well, as it turns out, on the basis of observations. I'll show you. But first, take the zero dissipation situation. So this is the solution of the three equations. With lambda, now remember lambda was omega 1 over omega 2 squared, and it's greater than 1. For this rattleback, commercial one, I've estimated it as being approximately 4. And you've got to impose initial conditions. So here's the initial pitching mode, initial rolling mode. And let's suppose they're very weak, because you try to spin it without introducing any perturbation, but inevitably you introduce a little bit of perturbation. You can't do it perfectly. But I've taken these to be small, and I've taken a positive spin, 0.5. Now the blue curve shows the resulting computed solution for the spin, blue. The red curve is the pitching amplitude. This is all as a function of tau, slow time variable. By the real motion, there's a lot of oscillation going on under these curves. This is sort of envelope. And green is the rolling mode. Now, sure enough, if we start with positive n and chirality is positive, then it's evident that you start off with very small, this 0.01, but it's unstable and a fairly rapid growth rate of the pitching instability. So it grows, and as a result, spin decreases and crosses the axis, because just sheer inertia will carry it over. As soon as it goes over to the other side, the red mode is stabilized. So what was exponential growth becomes exponential decrease. Now, this green mode started small and it's stable. It was exponentially decreasing as far as this point. And in fact, the amplitude is extremely small at this point, but Mathematica was just able to cope with it. And I did check very carefully that this is genuine. It exponentially decreased to this point, but now it begins to pick up exponentially with the same growth rate, sigma 2. And then that takes off. As you see, this is the rolling mode growing, but growing more slowly than the pitching mode. It's a weaker instability, but nevertheless it grows. And it grows. And now here's the spin. And as this mode grows, it begins to take energy out, and the magnitude of this n has to decrease again and cross over. As soon as it crosses, this begins to be stabilized. Now this mode has been exponentially decreasing all this time to here. And it's virtually zero. It's about 10 to the minus 8, I think, in the computation. It's of that order. But as soon as the spin reverses, it takes off again from this extremely small value, 10 to the minus 8. It takes a long time before it comes to life. It's got a long way to recover, as it were. But as soon as it does recover, boom, it happens again. And then we're into the periodic behavior. So you see why this is periodic. But that, of course, is neglecting dissipation. And obviously, if you neglect dissipation, total energy is going to be conserved. So it never comes to rest. And it's not. Why does that change? It's a good question. You see, that is the fun. How can? It looks as if the angular momentum is changing sign. Well, it is. Angular momentum about the vertical is changing sign. That's part of the paradox. You see it in the toy itself. But the reason is, as soon as you have a pitching instability, for example, then the frictional force at the point of contact exerts a torque about the center of gravity. Systematic, yes, it is there. You do have friction because it's rolling, it's no slip contact, and there is a frictional force at the point of it. There's also a normal reaction which can exert a torque. But the frictional force does exert a torque. About the center. And that torque, although it's going back and forward, the torque, because of the chirality, it turns out torque is systematically in the same direction and causes the reversal. Well, now, of course, that is absolutely unreasonable, so let's put in the friction factors and see what difference it makes. Now, this is, these equations are just my equations of motion, but with friction parameters. Now, lambda is still equal to 4, and dissipation parameters, well, a small one, 0.04, so it's small compared with 1, 0.08. You may ask why I chose different ones. Well, that's just trying to think about the modes and think about the effect of viscosity or of air viscosity or other frictional processes and which is going to provide the greatest damping. And it seems to me that most of the damping will occur in the actual spin mode itself. The spin. I'm not sure of this. This is a little bit empirical. We have a lot of freedom here in choices of these parameters. But with this choice, these are the computed curves, the initial conditions and the color code as before. So the blue is the spin, which again, you see the unstable pitching mode. And that unstable pitching mode takes out the energy and it reverses. As soon as it reverses, this mode becomes stable. This one becomes unstable. You can see a little growth. However, growth is very slight, and damping, mu 3, is acting on this spin all the time. So it's damping. And although this is growing, it's also damped, and it's just not quite enough to cause a second reversal. It doesn't reverse. It comes to rest. And that's what we observe. So these values, which are empirical, I don't know why we use the word semi-empirical, but they're empirical. They seem to describe pretty well what is happening here. And now this is the same, but... yes. Well, of course, you play around with these coefficients until you get the behavior you're looking for to some extent. And it's very easily done. This is starting with a spin in the opposite direction. So this is, you might say, the bad. And what are we now? This is the good direction. The good direction. There is a weak instability, green, but it is weak, you see. It's enough to cause a single weak reversal. Well, sometimes I do see this with the rattleback, and it does depend on the surface and so on. Sometimes you see just a little bit of a reversal at the end due to the rolling mode. Now, that was the same friction parameters. The weak reversal is induced at a late stage when the rotation is already extremely, it's weak when it happens, so you're not going to see very much. But that is what happens. And certainly it's so weak that the red or pitching instability just never takes off at all. It's damped. It's got its own damping, and the destabilizing effect of this positive spin is not sufficient to overcome the damping. Now there is an example with reduced friction coefficients. The first one, 0.01, this one, 0.02, and mu 3, 0.025. I do this deliberately because this shows 1, 2, 3, 4 reversals, and then everything damps out and comes to rest. 4 reversals. Now, you may or may not believe this, but we have constructed a rattleback in Cambridge. We'll come to that in a moment. Let you think about that. I have constructed a rattleback in Cambridge, in the lab. It's about this size. It's boat-shaped, beautiful object. And it has a rod which can be adjusted to a variable angle that's mounted on the top. And by careful adjustment of this object, we can get 4 reversals. And we can observe both instabilities, the pitching when it's going one way, the rolling mode when it's going the other way. It's all there, and it can be done. Well, I thought they just wouldn't. I'd have trouble with immigration. You've got to be careful. I've had trouble before with Euler's disk. Sorry. Well, now, this is the little bit about the semantics. The etymology of the word silt. And according to the Oxford, this is the larger, longer Oxford English Dictionary, says, though always, this is a direct quote, though always confused with Celt, pronounced Celt, as in Celtic peoples, of whom there are a few here, I am one myself. It is a separate word, pronounced silt. And definition, it's an implement with chisel-shaped edge of bronze or stone, found among the remains of prehistoric man, so I really wasn't making it up. Now, the original word is traced back, according to this dictionary, to the Book of Job in the Old Testament. This is the Vulgate Latin version, and you see stilo ferreo et plumbi lamina, vel, there it is, celti, sculpantur in silici. Translated as the second line here, but I give both verses because... Very interesting. Oh, that my words were now written. This is Job. Oh, that they were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever. Well, somehow, this word. Actually, it's some of the scholars that analyze these things think it may be a misprint for certi with an R, meaning forever. And so the word celt has got into the language for entirely the wrong reasons. But it's got into the language and it's been taken up by archaeologists. Archaeologists do use the word celt, you know, the archaeologists who dig among prehistoric remains. Celt is the accepted word for a stone of this sort of shape. And it is generally confused with the word Celt. And so it's often thought that these stones were originally found by the Celtic peoples on the shores of the North Sea, which may not be true. I would say that this sentiment, oh, that my words were now written, is a very appropriate sentiment, of course, for anyone, as I've said here, who is submitting, preparing a paper for publication in a scientific journal. We often have this sort of feeling. Now, I should show you, having referred to the rising egg, if I'm permitted, show you the rising egg problem. So perhaps we need the lights. And the rising egg I referred to as an example of dissipative instability, and it is. Here it is. You lay it down. And this is one way to determine whether an egg is hard boiled or uncooked, unboiled. I think this one is hard boiled, but this is the way to test it. There are various ways. I mean, you can cut it open, but this way you spin it, and it rises on its end. You see, it's very clear. It rises on its end. Now you may say, oh, that's obvious. There's a tendency to axisymmetrize. This is what fluid dynamicists would like to say. Natural, intrinsic tendency in all spinning systems. But that's not the case, because here's an object which I did find on the beach yesterday morning, which is an oblate spheroid. And we place it in equilibrium. That is already the axis, the vertical axis is the symmetry, axis of symmetry. And we'll spin that one and see what happens. It rises on its edge. So it's spinning about an axis and the spin is not axisymmetric. So that's the wrong explanation. Now the astrophysicist would say, oh no, here we know the explanation for this phenomenon. You minimize energy subject to prescribed angular momentum. It's what a well-known problem for spacecraft that are rotating in outer space and have some internal dissipative mechanism. But unfortunately, that is not the correct answer, because according to that, this object in in free space, it would behave in the same way, according to this theory, that it would be a correct theory in free space. But when it rotates with prescribed angular momentum and minimum energy, it rotates about its axis of greatest inertia, because the energy goes like angular momentum squared divided by inertia. So greatest inertia, least energy. That's the wrong way. This one rises on its end. So that's the second explanation. Knocked down. It's not correct. And the explanation, in fact, there's no escape from this. One has to solve this problem. You have to solve the equations and allow for slipping at the boundary. And it's that slow slip, gives slow rise relative to the rapid precession. There is a simple physical explanation, but it requires identification of an invariant. It's an adiabatic invariant, which is not the angular momentum. It is something called the Gellert invariant. It's the scalar product of the angular momentum and the vector from the center of mass to the point of contact. That Gellert invariant was known for the tippy top in the 1950s. But it's an exact invariant in that case, because we have a spherical surface. If you have a non-spherical surface, it's an adiabatic, and it's a slow, it's a nearly an invariant, but that's enough. If you now minimize the kinetic energy for prescribed Gellert constant, as it were, Gellert invariant, then you get the right way. The prolate spheroid ends upright, and the oblate spheroid ends on its rim. So that's the explanation in that case. Well, that's a bit of a digression, but I thought I'd... Sorry? Yes. Well, it's more difficult. It's rather difficult to spin it on its end. I don't think I can do it. So the easiest way to get it to spin on its end is spin it the other way, and it will rise on its end. You need the sort of leverage. Yes. Well, we'll try with the other one. An unboiled egg will not rise. It, because you spin it as fast as you can, and all the energy you put in is dissipated by the fluid motion inside. And there's not enough energy left to somehow lift it up. So I won't try it, because the danger is that it ends up on the carpet. It does work. Yeah. I'm sure that if you took an unboiled egg and put it into a machine to get it rotating fast for some time, so the core is spun up, and then release it onto a table, then it will rise. But it's just you're not able to do it fast enough by hand. Oh yes. I have a confession to make. They're both hard boiled. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Of course, that is the easier way. That's the easier way to do. Yes. Oh yes. Yes. So it's a good. There are so many ways that astrophysical behavior can be illuminated by these simple toys. Yes.
Can I come back to the angular momentum?
Yes.
It looks as though the equations you have are actually constant.
Did not. No, they don't. Without dissipation, dissipation is not the key. You get the reversals without any dissipation. You know, it reverses an infinite number of times. So the angular momentum about the vertical is not conserved. It actually oscillates, and it's because of the effect of the frictional force. When it goes into an instability, the frictional force acts and exerts a torque about the vertical through the center of mass. And that, yeah. No. I'm using the rolling condition. The rolling condition, you know, there's no relative motion at the point. So the point of contact where the friction force applies is instantaneously at rest. So the friction force does no work, but it nevertheless is a force that exerts a torque. Yeah. Well, I don't apply it. I'm not trying to suggest that planets sit on a table. I mean, you don't. I'm not applying it. I'm just saying this is a tabletop phenomenon. And I'm saying that the equations bear some similarity to the equations of the alpha omega dynamo. This is all I've claimed for the rattleback.
From the
sun.
The fascinating
object
is
Oh, yes. All right.
But
yes.
I'm sitting and wondering how I find this
point. Yeah, no, obviously you can't. There may be a mathematical analogy between one system and another, but I wouldn't push it beyond that.
Can I just pause for a moment? Have you finished your talk?
Yes. Thank you.
I'm sure you'll be prepared to have questions.
Yeah. Famous physicists.
Yes.
And others were bending over the approach. And suggested that you could learn something about geometric reversal. Could you comment further about that?
Well, the geomagnetic reversals, it's interesting, you see, that with a very simple third-order nonlinear system, you can get reversals. They're not random. This is periodic. Now, for the Earth's magnetic field, the simplest people have reduced the equations to similar third-order. I think of Robbins. Was it Fritz will know, student of Malthus, and Rikitaki did it first for the couple of disk dynamos, three equations, nonlinear. Which exhibit actually random reversals, because it's a strange attractor type of system. Well, it's more complex, but still quadratic nonlinearity. So, from that point of view, you know, again, there's a mathematical correspondence. You know, I was thinking of the there was a girl, Kathy Robbins, was it? Who was a student of Malthus, and she, coupled. I think coupled in effect poloidal and toroidal field, and maybe one measure of differential rotation or something. But the third order system gave reversals. Yeah. Yes. 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 Well, noise does foul it up. I mean, noise is there in the Mathematica program. And I find that if I try to change the parameters too far, so we get long periods of exponential decay, then unexpected things happen. And that's the effect of this tiny perturbations. So certainly, yeah, care is... Yeah, that's interesting. It'd be interesting to do that, to deliberately put a little noise in. Mm. I did say that. Bondi found that. But that occurs in his analysis only when N, the spin parameter, is large, order one or greater. Now, order one, you see, I'm spinning this egg at order one. Actually, it's got to be greater than five in these dimensionless parameters for it to become unstable in that and to rise to the vertical. And it's in that regime that Bondi found out this possibility. Both modes are unstable. But it's not relevant, really, for the way you play with the rattleback.
Yeah, it's something that we've done originally. If you're going to be novice in this case, it's going to be the best way to do it.
Oh. Even in a nonlinear, fully nonlinear. Well, energy, certainly energy, yes, if you assume the energy is conserved, that's a good starting point. Oh, using Lagrange's equations, you're not talking about Lagrangian variables in the fluid mechanical sense. Yes, using Lagrange's equations to, yes, that's a good way to arrive at.
And then, complicated dynamical reasoning, that was the way to.
Yes. But this is a non-holonomic system, which is a because of the rolling condition. You have no slip condition, and that's a non-holonomic constraint. Yeah, that's the problem with all rolling problems. All rolling problems have this nasty, and so I think there's just no escape. You've got to write down the equations. Yeah, no slip condition. Non-holonomic, because you've got, the velocity at the center of mass, u, say, plus omega cross x to the point of contact, that velocity is zero. And so you're relating velocities in that boundary condition. And that's non-holonomic. So it's nasty.
Bad idea, then.
Yeah. Yes. The egg is not—it's not a chiral. It's an entirely different phenomenon. The rise of the egg. The egg is axisymmetric. We treat it as axisymmetric, and we spin it, and it's unstable if spun sufficiently rapidly with its axis horizontal. Unstable. As soon as it tips off and the instability grows, you get slipping. And it's the slipping instability in this case. It's that friction is vital and dissipation of energy is vital. So it's in a very different phenomenon from the equations. That is what causes the rise. The center of mass rises, yes. But the kinetic energy decreases. Yeah, well, now I can eat the egg for lunch, you see. There's a very good thing about this sort of experiment. You do your experiment, then eat it. yes. Well, this... I had hoped to solve this problem while here. But I've been distracted by so many other things, so many lectures, so many discussions, etc., that it's not been possible. You might like to come and see this. This is a model of the Earth, because two spheres separated by a liquid outer core. but it's a little bit different, because the inner sphere is weighted below in such a way that it gives a beautiful impression of gliding along while remaining the same orientation. It looks as if it's slipping. You see that? It's a device for determining whether tables are horizontal or not. I thought that there. You see, it's not horizontal. The room is imperfect. I thought that spinning that rapidly would cause the inner sphere to invert, like the tippy top, as a result of dissipation in the liquid that separates the two. But now I believe that it's not quite the same. I having struggled a little bit with the equations while here, but not enough to be able to give a coherent account of this phenomenon. But if you like to see this toy, you're very welcome to. It is interesting, beautiful, beautiful, beautifully made, and rather astonishing.